Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Eric R. Eaton, entomologist, writer, editor, and consultant, and we're talking about his new book, Wasps, The Astonishing Diversity of a Misunderstood Insect. Eric, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
Now, I love insects. I love insects. But wasps for the general public are a tough sell.
Yeah.
Is that why you wrote this book?
Yeah, because our traditional social definition of wasps is vastly different from reality. And you know,
I think most people think of wasps as sort of bees with a bad attitude.
Right. But the yellow jackets, hornets, paper wasps, the social wasps that we interact with most frequently in a negative fashion, they're only a fraction of,
that's right,
of wasps. Most are solitary. Many do not sting. And of those that do, it's only the females, by the way, that sting, because it's a modification of their egg-laying organ, the sting. And so consequently, we kind of make this blanket association of wasps with negative things.
And I have to say, even for, I'm in Massachusetts, that even for wasps that really look mean, and I'll give you an example, cicada killer, then they're not really out to get you. They really aren't. They look like they should be out to get you, but they're not.
Right. Yeah. They're huge for one thing.
And so they look, for something, their look looks like they would come after you.
Yeah. And the irony with cicada killers is that the males, which don't sting, are the ones that are aggressive because they're territorial.
That's right.
And they drive out, any other organism that they think might be a threat to their harem of females. And the females are way too busy hunting cicadas, digging burrows that they nest in, and what have you, to bother with us.
Well, let's stay with the book for a second. The book itself is a beautiful book, and the layout is really makes it easy to read. Talk about that.
Well, that I owe to Unipress Books Limited for the design of it. The organization is what I came up with, but their execution of the layout really makes the book work. And we had an artist that worked with us, and she did great artwork. And then the photographers who contributed were just icing on the cake.
Let's talk about, I want to mention, each chapter is short. It's like 2 pages. Is each section, and then there are sort of larger conglomerations of those sessions. So you can dip into this whenever you want and learn something new.
Right. Yeah, that's in the digital age, for one thing, people's attention spans are a lot shorter than they used to
that's
be.
That's not a good thing. That's not a good thing.
Right, including my own, actually. So I want people to be able to pick it up and put it down at will. It's something you could read through from beginning to end if you wanted to do that also, but mostly I wanted people to be able to, like you said, pick it up at any point and hopefully learn something.
Well, let's talk about the evolution of wasps. Wasps, the first definite wasps that we know that we can identify as wasps, comes from fossils from the Triassic period of the Mesozoic era, and there's some beautiful photographs of wasps in amber and actual fossil wasps, but what is the relationship of bees and wasps? Are bees just a kind of wasp?
That's what we're beginning to think is the case, that bees are basically hairy wasps that went back to a vegetarian lifestyle, whereas wasps, as we tend to think of them, are either predators, scavengers, or in most cases, what we call parasitoids, and that means that they're parasites of other insects that almost inevitably kill their host. And that takes so many wild forms that that's another reason I had to write the book. I couldn't explain all that in an interview. It can range from mud daubers, for example, that sting spiders into paralysis and then stuff them in these mud cells that they create as food for their offspring. But then you've got other insects that will, you know, other wasps that, like ichneumon wasps, that lay their egg in a host and then leave, and then their larva offspring feast within the host. So it runs the gamut. There's wasps so tiny that they carry out their entire life cycle in the egg of another insect.
And then there's hyperparasitoids.
Yeah, that's a whole another level.
They're parasitic of other parasitic wasps,
or flies, or some other kind of parasitoid insect. Yeah, the way they execute that is really convoluted in many cases. Some are what we call facultative hyperparasites, meaning that they can exist as a parasitoid themselves, or they can be a parasitoid of another parasitoid.
Then there's
ones that are obligate hyperparasitoids, which means that they have to find another parasitoid within a common host. So, for example, a caterpillar, say. So the hyperparasitoid has to find another parasitoid within that caterpillar.
Wow.
If it doesn't, it dies.
Yikes. Okay, getting back to the evolution of wasps and bees. Talk about soft flies. You know, a lot of people don't even realize about soft flies. Most people, I don't even know if they see soft flies. You know, when people think of wasps, they think about the big wasps like hornets and stuff like in yellow jackets. But there are these interesting things called soft flies. Are those wasps?
They are, and they're among the most primitive in terms of baseline evolution. But you have to be careful because, you know, primitive in terms of characteristics does not mean you're not successful.
That's
and
right.
So,
right.
You know, soft flies are wildly successful, but they're not. You know, their anatomy and lifestyle is pretty basic. Their larvae are very much resemble caterpillars, and they feed in on foliage or within a plant, very much like a caterpillar. And so then as wasps advanced in their evolution, they went from vegetarians to a parasitoid lifestyle.
If I remember right, I've seen larvae, soft flies, and they're all in a group, and they sort of create these like sort of weird patterns of them lining up on a leaf or something like that.
Yeah, it's a means of group defense. Many soft flies will take the, you know, in the course of feeding, they will take the toxins within the plants that they're eating and convert them into defensive chemicals. And so
if you
harass a soft fly larva, it may rear up and spit goo out the front end or the back end or both. And they're often boldly colored to advertise the fact that they're distasteful.
Are most wasps social?
No, quite the opposite. More than 90% are solitary.
So only a few of them build these complicated nests like we see from the paper wasps and stuff like that.
Correct.
So the rest of them are just on their own?
Mm-hmm.
And that includes one of my favorite, because I haven't seen them yet. I want to talk about velvet ants, which aren't ants at all. They're essentially a wingless wasp?
The females are wingless, correct, yeah.
They're amazing looking, and I've looked for them, and I've never, ever seen them.
Well, they're pretty abundant, actually.
But even up here in the Northeast?
Oh, yeah. I spent 6 months in I spent 6 months in Amherst, and I found that going to, like, rail yards and other dry, sandy situations, I could find them pretty easily.
And they have sort of forbidding names like cow killer.
Right. Yeah, they pardon. Excuse me. They have a very painful sting for their size. And they use in defense. They're also very dense in terms of their body armor.
They're very tough to squish.
Yeah, but their hosts are usually other wasps, and so it pays to be able to deflect the stings and bites of your host in that case.
But if you see one, they look like this really colorful hairy ant, big. And so you might be tempted to, like, pick it up. But yeah, you really shouldn't.
Don't do that.
Now, they also, and this is something I learned from your book, they also produce sound.
Yeah.
By stridulation.
They can squeak. Yeah. They can squeak by rubbing their abdominal segments together.
Now, one of the things that I notice, especially obviously on ichneumon wasps, is their ovipositor. Talk about what that is on wasps, because I think a lot of people think that's their stinger.
Yeah. Yeah. A stinger, a true stinger, is a retractable organ. It's pretty short and sharp, and you won't see it until it's too late, basically. but for, yeah, these wasps that have these whip-like or spear-like organs coming out of their rear end, those are the eggling organs, and they're used to penetrate a host and or penetrate the substance that the host is in. So in the case of the really big ichneumon wasps, they drill into trees to reach their host, which ironically is another is the larva of another wasp called a horntail. And so it just drills into the wood to reach the horntail grub that's boring in the tree.
And a horntail, by the way, is another huge wasp.
Yeah.
I think that used to be called a pigeon killer or something like that.
No, it's called the pigeon tremex.
That's it.
The common one that you have there, and I don't know the derivation of that name.
But the funny thing is, I don't understand how they take this flimsy thing. We're talking about these, say, a giant ichneumon wasp. Their ovipositor is enormous. It's like longer than their body.
Yeah.
How do they get that drilled into the wood?
We're still kind of trying to figure that out.
Okay.
I mean, there's, you know, some people have suggested that they actually weave the the ovipositor through existing cracks and whatnot, or use an exit hole from a former horntail to get to the one below it, kind of thing. But the ovipositor is consists of, like, you know, a very thin filament surrounded by two bracing segments, and so it has some purchase from that.
Okay.
That it uses to get its ovipositor into the tree.
If you ever watch it, and these wasps are fascinating in their variety of forms, these ichneumon wasps, to me it always looks like the person's taking a hair from their head and trying to drill it into the tree, and it seems like impossible that they'd be able to do that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It is mind-boggling. And, you know, the mechanics are very difficult to observe, and I'm you know, I can't say for certain whether we've reached a conclusion about how they do that, to be honest.
Oh, wow.
Mostly we've been interested in the host parasite or host parasitoid relationships more than necessarily the mechanics of how they're delivered.
Now let's talk about the sting. Actually, the correct word is sting, not stinger?
That's my understanding, yes.
So they call it the sting. What is the venom? Is it the same venom through all the wasps, or does the venom vary from species to species?
Well, that's another interesting point I learned in researching this book, is that our definition of venom is changing. We tend to think of venom as a pain-inducing, tissue-damaging substance, and that's not always the case. And in wasps, venom is usually tailored to the host, and it's designed to, you know, to paralyze the host either temporarily or permanently. And it's very seldom used in self-defense. And so the effect of being stung depends on, you know, what the venom is needed for in the first place. And in the case of social wasps, it is a self-defense thing. It's a colony defense thing more than anything, because they're defending their helpless siblings that are in the larva or pupa stage, and they can't defend themselves. But for all other wasps, it's again tailored to the host, and it may take the form of, you know, a paralyzing agent, or it may actually work in concert with a virus in some cases to disable the host's immune system and or instruct its the host's brain to do something it doesn't normally do. I'm not going to give any spoilers here if you want the full story, but it's a lot more complicated than we would have dreamed of even, you know, a decade or two ago.
It's my understanding that the most toxic venom may not necessarily be the most painful venom as far as we're concerned.
That's exactly true. That's a very astute observation. So, for example, tarantula hawks, there are these enormous wasps that are...
Have you ever seen one of those?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're very common, actually, in the southwestern United States.
Because they look ridiculously huge.
They are.
they're like the size of the palm of your hand.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they're very sleek and slender, and they're colorful. They're kind of metallic blue with orange wings or red wings.
Wow.
In many cases, anyway. But yeah, they're obviously their venom is supposed to be used to paralyze a tarantula, which they then furnish as food for their larval offspring. But if it stings a human, it just causes intense, excruciating pain for about 3 minutes, and then that's the end of it. There's no tissue damage, nothing. There's no component to the venom that adversely affects a person, except from the standpoint of it being really painful.
I interviewed years ago an expert on insect venom and toxin, and he wrote that most of the injuries caused by being stung by a tarantula wasp was from people running around like crazy and like doing things like falling off a cliff and stuff like that. That it's so painful that people do stupid things, and that's how they get injured.
That could very well be true. Was that Justin Schmidt?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And because it looks like it would deliver an absolutely freaky amount of pain. If you've ever seen one of these wasps, and I've only seen pictures of them, they are just so huge and mean-looking. It's incredible. But I'm fascinated by them, and I definitely want to see them. You have a list of the top 10 stingers in the book, too. Have you been stung?
Oh, no. I think it's unavoidable if you have any kind of an interest in wasps. I kid people that I think the reason I got into wasps initially was because, you know, none of my teenage peers could call me a sissy for catching something that could fight back.
So it was like on a dare?
No, I just was like, you know, okay, well, other people are catching butterflies, you know, let me look at something different. And then the more I learned about them and, you know, their behaviors and life histories, the more fascinating they became just for that reason alone.
Are all wasps sexually dimorphic? That was something I learned out of your book that was fascinating, too. Some are?
Yeah, most, but the degree of dimorphism is quite variable. I mean, the most extreme is the velvet ants and their kin, which the female is wingless and the male is winged and usually much larger than the female.
I want to talk about these big nests, the paper wasp nests, which are so dramatic. And when winter comes, before when the leaves are all gone, people start seeing those enormous, like almost watermelon-sized nests hanging in trees. How are they making those nests?
Well, they start out much smaller, obviously. a single queen, you know, starts the nest, and she builds a paper comb of plant fibers that she chews up, and then covers it in an envelope also of the same material. And as her workforce, as her workforce builds, they add to it and expand it.
Now, what happens in the wintertime in those nests? Because I've seen a lot of dead wasps once the first couple of severe freezes happen. Underneath a paper wasp, is the queen still alive inside?
Well, finds a different, sturdier shelter, like a rotten log or something to spend the winter in. But yeah, it's the only the queen that
survives,
and there'll be new queens that the colony. Oh dear, there's the colony produces new queens at the end of the year as well, and so they all go off and individually and find places to overwinter.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Eric R. Eaton, entomologist, writer, editor, and consultant. And we're talking about his book. And I'm going to strongly recommend it because I think it's a great book about a misunderstood group of insects, wasps. The astonishing diversity of a misunderstood insect. Now, talk to me about other wasp sort of living quarters, because I've seen mud dauber. And I've seen some of these, like, pipe organ wasps, places that they live, and they are absolutely fascinating to look at.
Yeah, and that's the work of a single female wasp, yeah.
And there, she's gathering up little bits of mud from, like, a puddle and then forming these like, look like pipe organ tubes?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, are wasps, like bees, pollinators?
They're properly called flower visitors because they're there for nectar. In most cases, actually, I have to qualify that, because there are some wasps, like pollen wasps, that are relatives of yellow jackets but solitary, that do harvest pollen instead of prey items. So there's other wasps where the wasp and a flower have evolved together.
Wow.
And created this situation in which the flower looks like a female wasp, and so it attracts, and it smells like a female wasp, and everything. And so the male wasp comes thinking he's going to have a good time, and all he winds up doing is pollinating this silly flower.
Can we talk about galls? Because I think a lot of people see galls, but they don't know what they are. Like, say, oak galls, for instance, on an oak tree.
Yeah, galls are the ones made by insects, anyway. They're not damaging to the plant. their growth is triggered by either the egg laying of the female wasp or the eating activity of her larval offspring.
So you'll see these things; they look like little balls on the leaves. And you can't figure out what's going on, whether they're dying of some kind of fungus. That's got a larva inside, right?
Yeah. Yeah, one or more.
And then they hatch. And what happens to the gall eventually? It just falls off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, you have a great section about how beautiful wasps are. Some of them are iridescent. There's a picture in your book of the jewel wasp, which I've never seen, which is just absolutely amazing. And then you have a term I've never read the term for, aposematism.
Yeah, that basically explains why wasps are so colorful. It's a way to advertise that you can sting, but a lot of wasps that don't sting, carry off the hoax by being colored like wasps that do sting.
Well, there's a lot of flower flies that look like wasps too.
That's true too. Lots of different insects.
Right. You have this section of mimics of wasps. And I knew about flower flies and a couple of other ones, but geez, there's a lot of insects that are really fooling people that look like there are moths, there are katydids, something called the wasp mantis fly. I've seen mantis flies, but I haven't seen that one. And flies of all sorts of mimic wasps so that you sort of leave them alone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they don't only look like them, they act like them as well. And you go into the tropics, and it's a whole other ball game. There's so much diversity down there.
Well, that's true of all invertebrates. When you go to the tropics, invertebrates go wild. Now, talk to me about nocturnal wasps. I didn't know about that either.
Yeah, well, here in the United States, we have if you turn on your porch light, you might wind up attracting certain Ichneumon wasps and what have you that are out looking for their caterpillar hosts at night, because that's often when caterpillars feed, and so it's easier to locate them at night than it is during the day.
Now, finally, and we're almost out of time, you can help wasps, and they're part an important part of the ecosystem, by building little wasp hotels for the winter. Talk to me about what that's like. What do you do?
Well, if you go to any website about pollinators, you'll see these things called bee blocks or bee condos.
Yeah.
Okay, well, they're also utilized by a lot of solitary wasps. So if you do your part for housing for our native bees, you're also helping native wasps.
And so what you do is you pile a lot of little hollow, like reeds and pieces of wood in sort of like a sort of block, and they'll go inside and spend the winter there?
Well, oh, dear. They're not spending the winter there. They're nesting in there.
Okay.
And they'll overwinter in an immature stage, not as adults.
Okay. And where would they be overwintering? Where are wasps overwintering? Just under the ground or in leaf litter or what?
Here, I was afraid this would happen. Well, it depends. I mean, like social wasps, as we mentioned, the queens will find crevices and hollow logs and things like that. But other wasps are overwintering as pre-pupa inside their nest underground or in a twig or in a mud dauber nest, that kind of thing.
My guest tonight has been Eric R. Eaton. He's fighting off allergies, horrible allergies. He's an entomologist, writer, editor, and consultant, and we've been talking about his book. I really recommend this book, Wasps, The Astonishing Diversity of a Misunderstood Insect. Eric, go take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.